Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Linzag, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the fight against ISIS. With me to discuss the lessons of the campaign to degrade and destroy the Islamic State is Michael Gordon. Michael is the national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He was previously the chief military correspondent for the New York Times. Michael has co-authored three critically acclaimed books with the late Bernard Traynor, a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General on America's wars in Iraq. The first, The General's War, covered the Gulf War. The second, Cobra II, examined the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And the third, The Endgame, covered the war through the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011. Michael is now out with his fourth book about America's involvement in Iraq, Degrade and Destroy, the inside story of the war against the Islamic State from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Congratulations on the publication of Degrade and Destroy. Like the three books you wrote with General Traynor, it has gotten rave reviews. One of you I'm looking at right now calls it, and I quote, the definitive record of a critical chapter in the fight against extremism. So I'm wondering, Michael, as we sort of look back on the rise and fall of the Islamic State, why was the Islamic State able to come to power?
Well, it was a result of a number of factors, many of them indigenous, and some of which had to do with the United States. But on the first count, the Islamic State, or ISIS, as it came to be known, is really a rebranding and a follow-on to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the militant organization that arose during the U.S. occupation. And it was a group that the United States defeated but did not entirely destroy during its period in Iraq. And after U.S. forces left in 2011, it was able to reinvent itself and find fertile ground. A part of that was the result of sectarian policies of Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's prime minister, who alienated further many of the Sunnis in the country and made them more receptive to the sort of message that ISIS was putting out. Part of it was a result of the fact that the U.S. left Iraq militarily at the end of 2011 and then took its eye off the ball, wasn't mentoring the Iraqi forces, and didn't have a good feel for what was happening in the country.
So, Michael, why did we underestimate the adversary in the Islamic State? You report that Major General Mike Nagata, after visiting Iraq in February of 2014, remarked that the Iraqis were now telling me about enemy tactics, weaponry, and a degree of combat sophistication that was alien to me, even though I spent 3 years doing multiple rotations in Iraq.
Well, there was a civilian-military divide, by and large, in the American government, where the U.S. military had a better understanding of the threat and what needed to be done to counter it than the civilians in the Obama administration, including in the White House. And even before U.S. forces left Iraq, it was well understood by Iraqi generals, by American generals, that there was a need for a continuing U.S. presence to train and enable Iraqi forces. And after they left, there were defense attaches in the embassy, and there were people like General Nagata and people like Colonel Kristanyu, the head of the Delta Force, who visited Iraq and reported back that the best of the Iraqi forces, its counterterrorism service, was having a really hard time dealing with this ISIS threat. ISIS was applying paramilitary tactics. It was conducting itself more as a terrorist army than as a terrorist organization. And the Iraqi forces were stretched thin, worn down, and were having a lot of difficulty contending with it. This was well known on the U.S. military side, to the point that the Delta Force began making plans for when they thought they would have to go back in. But at the White House, they were contending with an array of crises in the Middle East, Egypt, chemical weapons in Syria. And there was also a sense on the part of President Obama and his aides that the U.S. had turned the page on military involvement in Iraq. And so it took a shock for them to change their assessment of that. And that shock was the fall of Mosul to ISIS in June of 2014.
Well, it certainly came as a shock to President Obama because he had told the American public that he had brought the war in Iraq, or at least the American involvement in the war in Iraq to a respectable end. And he himself had dismissed the threat posed by the Islamic State. There's the famous quote he made, if a JV team puts on Lakers uniforms, that doesn't make them Kobe Bryant. I'm curious, Michael, how was it that the Islamic State was able to make the transition from being a terrorist organization, as you put it, to actually fielding what looked like an effective terrorist arm?
Well, first off, the very month that President Obama made that statement to the New Yorker about the JV team was the very same month that General Nagata and Colonel Donahue went to Iraq and reported back that the situation was very fragile and that the Iraqis couldn't attend to this new threat. So what President Obama's assessment then would not have been supported by what the assessment on the ground from the U.S. military at the time. And there were also, a number of entreaties on the part of the Iraqis for help, to include an August 2013 meeting between Hoshyar Zebari, then the Iraqi foreign minister, and General Dempsey. And there was a letter to Jake Sullivan, who was then the national security advisor to Vice President Biden, from the Iraqi ambassador in Washington, Luke Manfaley, in May of 2014, asking for help. So it was sort of known by people who were paying close attention that the situation wasn't a good one. Now, clearly, President Obama was surprised by the extent to which the situation had disintegrated, in fact, expressed his disappointment in that to his own commanders in a famous session.
Can you tell us a little bit about that session, Michael?
Sure. And of course, I wasn't there. But
you're an ace reporter, and you've talked to a lot of people who were in the room.
Well, I do have information about it. And I think in his mind, President Obama was very much committed to turning the page in Iraq. And he very much didn't want to have to go back in militarily and was hoping that the Iraqis would be able to handle it. But it became abidingly clear after the fall of Mosul in June, and then after ISIS pivoted and began to threaten Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish autonomous region in Iraq, that the U.S. would have to do something. And there was a meeting in the Situation Room that was attended by President Obama, General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Lloyd Austin, the CENTCOM commander, was beamed in.
Current Secretary of Defense.
And I was told reliably that President Obama expressed, for a man who was famous for maintaining his sense of composure and not expressing emotion and being cool and unflappable, in this case, his frustrations bubbled over, and he expressed his disappointment in rather pointed terms at his own generals for having kind of let the country down. And why was this Iraq crisis have been allowed to happen to the point where he had to make a decision about intervening militarily to, at a minimum, stop Erbil from falling into ISIS hands? And in the book, I quote General Dempsey on the record as on this session. And he said, well, he was philosophical about it. He said, well, I took it as the president was disappointed that the Iraqi army had fallen apart so far. But I think President Obama was not expressing his concern at the Iraqi army. He was asking his commanders, what gives here? And I think I was told General Austin at the time took it harder. But it was soon after that that Obama did make the call, to his credit, to intervene with airstrikes, prevent ISIS from moving on Erbil, and set in motion a process whereby the U.S. would come back into Iraq, but in a very different way than it had been in before. Not with tens of thousands of troops, but with small teams of advisors, and the Iraqis were to do the main fighting. That said, it was 2 years of learning before the U.S. arrived at the right formula to really make it work. But while President Obama has been criticized, along with Nouri al-Maliki, for presiding over a failed negotiation that allowed American forces to leave Iraq, he has to be credited with making the tough call to send them back in once ISIS was gaining ground in Iraq.
Michael, I want to talk about what this buy with and through strategy means in practice, or meant in practice. But before we do that, can you give me a sense of why it is that the Iraqi military, which the United States invested a lot of time and money in, fell apart so quickly in Mosul? After all, Mosul isn't a small outpost. It is Iraq's second largest city.
Yes, this is the Afghan military didn't do so well either after the U.S. left, and nor did the Iraqis. Part of it has to do with the way the U.S. mentors these forces. And I saw a lot of that since I was involved in all three of our wars in Iraq, Desert Storm, the invasion of Iraq and occupation, and then the fight against ISIS. But when the U.S. left Iraq, there were still a lot of gaps in Iraqi capabilities when it left in 2011. In the area of logistics, in the area of combined arms, maintenance. They didn't have an air force. And this was no surprise. General Mike Barbera gave a briefing to the Iraqi military and basically anyone who would listen of what the deficiencies would be were the U.S. to leave at the end of 2011. But when you're fighting an insurgency, usually what happens is the U.S. wants to maximize the number of troops, partner forces it can get on the ground, soldiers it can get into the fray. Things like logistics and air power and maintenance are generally left for last. And the U.S. can buttress the partner forces with contractors, with its own capability, with its own air. But if a military is going to be left on its own entirely, which is pretty much what happened at the end of 2011, they really need to have these capabilities. So number one, the Iraqi military was a work in progress, and that work was not done by the time the U.S. left Iraq, which is why the U.S. military kept urging the White House not to leave. They understood it would be taking a chance. So that's one reason. The other reason is after the U.S. left Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki acted in an increasingly autocratic and sectarian way. He installed a lot of cronies in the Iraqi military. That certainly didn't help. And then as his regular forces failed to maintain security, Maliki increasingly turned to the CTS, the Counterterrorism Service, which was sort of an elite force but became jack of all trades in Maliki's Iraq. It was used to do everything from guard prisons to retake cities. They're pretty much worn out. So there are a number of reasons why the Iraqi forces didn't perform well, to include, you know, corruption and bad leadership. But if the U.S. had been in Iraq after 2011, it would have been in a position to at least address this deterioration and try to ameliorate it. And it certainly would have been cognizant of it. The reason Mosul was such a shock to the White House was not only that ISIS was more capable than al-Qaeda in Iraq, which it was. It was, as I said, more of a terrorist army than just a terrorist group. But it was also because the Iraqi army had disintegrated to an extent that the White House didn't appreciate. They lost their window into what was happening to the very force the U.S. spent billions creating. And the confluence of those two events is what led to such surprise at the fall of Mosul.
And Mosul fell in just about a week in June of 2014. And by the end of 2015, the Islamic State would dominate territory going from Western Iraq to Northeastern Syria, with as many as 8 to 12 million people under their rule. Let's talk about the Obama administration's response. I guess the operation was called Operation Inherent Resolve, but the basic logic was this buy with and through. How did it actually play out, Michael?
Well, there was a little bit of trouble coming up with a name for the operation, because you can't just name an operation in the U.S. military. There's a naming convention, and it has to, different commands can name operations that have to start with a certain set of letters, and they can have a certain number of words.
Everything's bureaucratized.
It was a process that took weeks and involved a large number of general officers, because I read a FOIA of the naming process.
Freedom of Information Act request.
One of the early candidates was Iraqi Resolve, even though what had happened in Mosul was the absence of Iraqi Resolve. Then Iraqi Unity, even though ISIS's advance had shown the degree to which Iraq was not unified. And they were keying in on those names. And then somebody came to the realization that an American response would of necessity have to include military action in Syria, which is where ISIS had its capital, and Raqqa. Couldn't allow them to have a sanctuary. And so Iraqi Unity, Iraqi Resolve didn't work. So they wanted to start it with an I, and it became Inherent Resolve. No one quite knew what it meant, but at least it didn't offend anybody, and it seemed innocuous enough. The original vision of the Obama administration, which was feeling its way, was first Maliki had to go before they would come back in a significant way. And that did happen, largely thanks to Ayatollah Sistani, who decreed there had to be a new prime minister, who's the foremost Shia cleric.
And Maliki is a Shiite, and the Islamic State is Sunni Muslim.
Right. And so the Shia had to pick a new leader, and that was a requirement for American reentering the war, so to speak. But Obama's kind of requirement was that the U.S. was not to go into ground combat. We weren't going to do the fighting on the ground for them. That, by the way, held largely for the campaign, although there were some conspicuous exceptions, including in West Mosul, that were made to help the Iraqis along. But A, he didn't want to send U.S. forces back into ground combat. His second thing is that the U.S. role is to basically be an advisory role. The local forces were to do the fighting. And in fact, in the early months and really years of the conflict, the U.S. advisors, with the exception of special operations, were confined to bases and were trying to advise the Iraqis and the Kurdish Peshmerga remotely. By the way, that didn't work very well. But they were operating within these constraints that were imposed by Washington. So Obama's vision was the partners will do the fighting, we will advise them. Now, there's a long tradition, to get to your question, in the U.S. military by with and through. It's really a special forces, special operation forces concept. By meanings your partners, the fighting is done by your partners with U.S. support and help, enablers, air power, intel, whatever you want to provide, and through some set of agreements or legal framework. What was unique about this war was while by, with, and through had been done with special forces A teams, been applied on a smaller scale in Afghanistan, this was really done on an industrial scale. You had U.S. forces working with a multitude of partners who, by the way, didn't all like each other or get along. Iraqi military, Iraqi counterterrorism service, Iraqi federal police, three separate forces that report to separate ministries, Kurdish Peshmerga, Syrian Kurds, YPG, Syrian Arabs. They had to work with all of these different elements in two different countries simultaneously, harnessing the U.S. monopoly of air power in this conflict and reconnaissance. And it had never really been done on such a scale before, but it really took a few years to get it right in terms of the balance of risk and that the U.S. was willing to entertain to make this work.
Now, Michael, at some point you spent time on the ground in Iraq. You were embedded, I believe, at some point. What was that like?
Well, I spent time in all of these conflicts, because you can't cover them from the Pentagon briefing room. But it's important to go back and forth. So the way I've approached my coverage for the New York Times and or for any publication, for the Journal or for these books, is I would do a lot of shoe leather reporting in Washington on the policy decisions as they were being debated. And then I would go out to the battlefield and see what the situation was there. Very often these are parallel universes that did not overlap upon a policy decisions that were being pondered in Washington sometimes had something to do with what was happening on the battlefield. And what was happening on the battlefield sometimes was occurring independently of what was being discussed in the Congress and in Washington. In this conflict, there was no U.S. embedding. Don Rumsfeld had created that for the invasion of Iraq for a variety of reasons, but the U.S. military and the Obama administration didn't have an embedding policy. If you asked to embed with U.S. forces, as I did, they'd say, you can't do that. But this was by, with, and through. So I didn't need
to. You're an ingenious, determined reporter.
Well, this is what everybody did who covered this. You can go with the Kurdish Peshmerga, as I did to Sinjar in 2015, or as I did in Mosul in 2016. You can go with the Iraqi Counterterrorism Service, as I did in West Mosul in 2017. They're happy to take you. You go without all the, well, security and safety that you would have if you were with a U.S. military unit. There are no U.S. advisors in sight, by the way. They're behind you. There's no obvious medevac either if a situation arises, other than somebody might throw you in a vehicle and drive you back, you know, to where you came from. But so there were those possibilities. And they were doing the main fighting, so it enabled you to get up close to the action. The other thing I would say, while the U.S. military didn't embed, I was able to do what the Pentagon calls battlefield circulation. So I went around with General Townsend once for a day, which had the unintended consequence that ended up in a top-level meeting with the Iraqi prime minister and all of his generals, that neither General Townsend, the commander of the whole war for the U.S. And I anticipated when we set about that day, it just sort of happened. And I went around with Colonel Pat Work, who is the advisor to the Iraqi commander for the Battle of Mosul, Abdul Amir. And so there were those kind of opportunities to learn things and soak up information. And that material really forms the heart of the book. And really what I spent a number of years doing was taking that material and then going back and trying to understand, so what was happening while I was in this place? What were the decisions that were made before then? What were the alternatives to the extent they were debated? Why did they do it this way and not some other way? And what was happening in other parts of Mosul where I wasn't at the same time? What was the actual strategy that the U.S. and its allies had? Because there was a strategy. And it was really only afterwards that I was able to establish what that strategy was. Because at the time, there's just so much activity and violence and human misery that it's overwhelming. And you have to kind of go back afterwards and report out these decisions.
Michael, when you say there was a strategy, do you mean this by, with, and through, or do you have something else in mind?
No, there was an actual strategy for how to take West Mosul and East Mosul. And one of the challenges early on is when you have a local partner, the plus for the U.S. side is, well, you don't have to occupy the place. That's their problem. Second, they're taking most of the casualties, not you. The U.S. only lost 20 KIA in this whole war.
Killed in action.
Iraqis lost thousands. The Syrians lost thousands. Our Syrian partners, civilians were much greater. They take most of the casualties. They have the occupation duties, but because you're advising them and you're not directly in the ground warfare, except in some, you know, occasions when it became necessary and limited, your influence with them is a very delicate thing. And you can't tell them what to do. You can try to guide them what to do. You can try to exert your influence. And in order to have influence, you have to help them when they need it. And Pat Work, who was the colonel who advised Iraqis for the Battle of Mosul, said the philosophy was deposit, 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 so you can make withdrawal, help them with logistics, with armored bulldozers, with the air power they need to move forward. And then at key moments, try to influence the decision-making. A key moment came in April 2017 when the Iraqis were stalled in the battle for Mosul. They were pushing up from the south, and the campaign wasn't getting much of anywhere. ISIS had had years to prepare its defenses. The Iraqis were taking a lot of casualties. There were horrible situations. In one case, Federal police battalion commander and a few of his policemen took a wrong turn in Mosul, were captured by ISIS and held. And this became known to the Iraqi federal police commander. And what he decided to do was call an artillery strike on his own soldiers because he felt he had to put them out of their misery and prevent ISIS from exploiting it. That's the kind of war.
He feared that they were going to torture then kill his soldiers.
Yeah, he figured they're as good as dead. And that was the action he took. It's something the U.S. military couldn't have done. But again, it's their war. So that was the situation in April of 2017. It was stalled. And I know Jared Kushner went out there with, you know, the U.S. Homeland Security Advisor, the NSC, and all that, and gave some exhortations to the Iraqis around that time frame. But it was a difficult thing. But to unstick it, the U.S. had to persuade them to open up a second front. It had to come from the north, and it had to involve Iraq's lone armored division. That was the ground strategy. And to make that happen, the U.S. had to persuade General Townsend, Pat Work, U.S. Intel, the Iraqis at all level of their command that they had to overhaul their strategy and do something that in the meeting I sat in, the Iraqi prime minister said he was never going to do, send Iraq's lone ground force into urban combat again in West Mosul, because they had their nose bloodied earlier in the war. So there were those kinds of strategic decisions. There was a rationale behind them, a logic behind them. They were key milestones in the war. And that's a lot of what I tried to flesh out and pin down in doing this book. You know, what were they and how did they come about? The U.S. role was essential because the U.S. provided the air, it provided the intel, provided a lot of other forms of support, but its military device at key junctures of the war was also essential, although there were times when the U.S. was just unable to call the shots.
Now, Michael, I will note the Battle of Mosul takes place in 2017. This is when Donald Trump is president. You mentioned Jared Kushner. Donald Trump, obviously, during the election campaign in 2016, ran as a staunch critic of Barack Obama, said he was going to do things differently in Iraq. Did the Trump administration change the contours of the American strategy in Iraq after Trump took the oath of office in January of 2017?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is the Battle of Mosul actually begins in the eastern part of the city in the fall and winter of 2016, and it's carried over into the Trump administration in 2017. And by the time President Obama leaves office, a number of important decisions have been made by the military. They had pushed advisors forward, so they were no longer being confined within the limits of U.S. military bases. That happened just before Mosul. They were able to go and down the battalion level, and then during the Mosul fight, General Townsend signed an order that allowed them to move even more forward. They still weren't supposed to be directly involved in combat, but they were closer to the action. U.S. Apache helicopters were in there. The command structure was overhauled. Air power, the use of air power was extended to involve what we call deep strikes against ISIS targets. A lot of things happened during President Obama's tenure by the military, essentially, but with White House acquiescence. So by the time President Trump took over, the strategy was pretty well developed, and he didn't change it. He didn't do any of the things he implied he was going to do during the election campaign. He didn't change the rules of engagement. I think during the campaign, he vowed we would bomb the heck out of ISIS, except he didn't use the word heck, and none of that was changed. What did happen was the level of micromanagement that the Obama administration sometimes engaged in at the White House of military operations was pretty much washed away by H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor. So there was less scrutiny of what was happening out there, and there were fewer requirements for approval of specific operations. So as a consequence, what President Trump did essentially was he carried out the Obama strategy, but at times somewhat more efficiently than Obama himself, because he was paying, the White House was delegating a lot of those decisions to Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who was in turn delegating them to the commanders in theater.
Michael, we've talked a lot about the battle against the Islamic State in terms of what happened in Iraq, but there was also fighting in Syria. And I think one of the really interesting parts of the book is when you talk about some of the risks for escalation, particularly in early 2018, when U.S. forces destroyed a convoy of Russian private military contractors, first time U.S. and Russian forces had come into contact since the end of the Cold War. Can you tell us a little bit about that and sort of how the Syria piece fits into all of this?
Syria was an extraordinary and still is a complicated situation where you have a lot of outside forces threatening to intervene or actually intervening there. And the Russians came in 2015. And what the Russians did there was rather effective. It's in contrast to what they've done in Ukraine in terms of the military skill that they've used. It's primarily on the Russian side, an air war. They don't have a large ground component. They let the Iranians and the Shia militias be the cannon fodder. They did pretty much prop up this Bashar al-Assad regime. They accomplished their goal of keeping Assad in power and also establishing a Middle East presence that everybody in the region has to reckon with, including Israel. But the Russians had their own version by, with, and through, so to speak. They were doing air power, but on behalf of the Assad forces, Iranian-backed militias were on the ground. And there was also a paramilitary force out there called the Wagner Group, which was separate from the Russian armed forces, and it's actually active in Ukraine right now. And there was an operation that began where there was a lot of jockeying between the Russians and the Americans for some of the oil assets and gas fields east of the Euphrates. And the Euphrates served as kind of a dividing line, more or less, between where the U.S. advisors were and the U.S. forces-backed partners were, the Syrian Democratic Forces under Mazlum Syrian Kurdish commander, the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrian army and all those guys were. And there was an occasion where a fairly substantial force began to gather, and it became pretty apparent to the Americans that they had every intent of moving east, and this was going to be a potential clash. It wasn't a surprise. This was studied. The U.S. thought about its response. And there were communications on a hotline between the U.S. and Russian military. The Americans kept saying, are these your guys? Because this looks like it could be a problem. The Russian military pretended that it didn't know anything about it. When the attack came, the U.S. initially began to try to warn them off with a few warning shots, but it became a full-blown fight. And a couple of hundred probably Russians were killed in that. That's what Secretary Pompeo said at his confirmation hearing. He was the first one to put on the record what was then considered kind of a classified assessment. And during the middle of this, of the fray, the Russian military contacted the Americans and said, well, hey, can we have a pause so we can retrieve the bodies? So it was quite clear at that point they had a little better understanding of what was going on than they initially pretended. One thing that was really striking about this, after this was over, there was a meeting between then the U.S. National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, and his Russian counterpart, Patrushev, who's there today advising Putin on Ukraine. And I asked, so my God, the U.S. has just killed a couple hundred Russian paramilitary guys. Granted, they weren't wearing Russian military uniforms, but they're clearly affiliated in some way with the Russian effort in Syria. What were the repercussions of this? And I was told McMaster didn't raise it and Patrushev didn't raise it. The entire episode was sort of swept under the rug, and the Russians publicly sort of denied they had anything to it. There were a few other instances of U.S.-Russian near confrontations. There was a time when a Russian general demanded the U.S. leave a base in southeast Syria at Antonov Garrison in 48 hours or else, and he was pretty much talked down from that by General Townsend, who said, are we going to talk or fight? And there were a few other episodes where when the U.S. Delta Force flew to northwest Syria to get Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, they had to clear into airspace. It was pretty much controlled by the Russians. They asked permission to do that, were denied permission, went anyway. Nothing happened in terms of U.S.-Russian dynamics. A lot happened to Baghdadi. So there were those sorts of tensions. So what's the lesson? The lesson is the U.S. and Russian military were pretty careful about managing the risks of direct conflict between their two militaries, and that when there was conflict, it was carried out by a Russian proxy force that they were prepared to disown if things turned bad, which they did for that force.
Michael, I want to close by talking about what you take to be the lessons of this buy, with, and through strategy. Is this a template for the future? Is it something we're seeing in Ukraine today? Or is this a one-off that succeeded because the conditions were just right in Iraq in dealing with the Islamic State?
So there's a saying that, you know, people often want to refight the last war. But what's happened now is among the pundits and even to some extent in the Pentagon itself, everybody has moved on from this conflict. And the focus of the Pentagon, the National Defense Strategy, is on what Secretary Austin calls the pacing threat, China, which is the main threat they're concerned about, at least in terms of their policy and doctrine. Russia is a secondary threat. They call it the acute threat, which is something you got to worry about, but not as bad as the pacing threat, which is the looming danger on the horizon. The Pentagon, you know, has not done a history of the counter-ISIS fight. It hasn't done one.
You've done it for them.
They may not see it that way, but there's a RAND Corporation study of the air side. There's a few little short pieces by the Army's Asymmetric Warfare Group on Mosul and Raqqa that don't go very deep. There's not been an overall look at this by the Pentagon, which to my mind is rather astounding. But I believe that this counter-ISIS fight has significance and relevance for the future, and it is as follows. While our focus is on China and Russia, what the 2018 National Defense Strategy calls great power competition, the Biden team is going to change the label and call it integrated deterrence, basically the same thing. The threats in the Middle East and in other ungoverned spaces have not entirely gone away, and you can't say that they'll be gone for all time. But we're not going to send tens of thousands of troops back to fight these terrorist or militant organizations should they arise again. We're going to have to do some variation of buy, with, and through. where you have small teams of U.S. advisors, significant U.S. air power, intelligence, reconnaissance, lashed together in a way that you can carry out effective operations. Now, didn't work so well in Afghanistan, but it did work in Iraq and Syria. So how do you do this? You have to have a partner that has street cred in whatever culture you're operating in. They have to have a certain degree of credibility with their own environment. And you have to deal with a situation where the enemy doesn't have an obvious sanctuary, as was the case in Afghanistan, but wasn't the case for ISIS since we followed them into Syria. But it has utility, certainly against those kind of threats in the future. And I would argue that scaled back versions of it could also have some use in a great power competition. You know, we don't have advisors with the Ukrainian army now, but we did train the Ukrainian army, 10th Special Forces Group. We're not carrying out the airstrikes for Ukraine now, but we're at least providing HIMARS and some of the intelligence that's enabling them to carry out precision strikes. So you could say that some attenuated version of this strategy is what's being pursued in Ukraine now, because the U.S. doesn't want to go toe-to-toe with a nuclear-armed adversary. So I think there are lessons there, and it is also a war the U.S., by any reasonable measure, won, at least militarily, and there certainly haven't been that many of those lately. So it deserves recognition.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Michael Gordon, National Security Correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and the author of the terrific new book, Degrade and Destroy, the Inside Story of the War Against the Islamic State, from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Brett, thank you.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. We love the feedback. You can find the books and documents mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, none of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Rafaela Seward with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Rafaela did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Raf. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Linzag. Thanks for listening.